compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Thanks for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. I think you'd probably agree with me. I'm guessing you would probably agree with me that if you met somebody from communist China who was going to explain to you what things were like there, that person would be in a pretty good position to understand and to share with you what the circumstances are in communist China, because obviously that person's from communist China. Well, something similar, really actually something exactly like that, took place recently, in which a Chinese woman is speaking at, now I want to get the specifics on this one. So she's speaking at a school board meeting, and she herself is a survivor of Chairman Mao's Cultural Revolution. And if you're not familiar with the details of that, Mao Zedong, he wiped out something along the lines of like 60 million Chinese folk. It got so bad that that his minions were killing people, even just for the crime of wearing glasses, because if you wore glasses, they assumed you were probably more of an intellectual. And if you were an intellectual, then you were a danger to the state. So they would kill you. Countless people murdered in the name of godless communism, and literally in the name of godless communism. The two go hand in hand. So what you're going to hear now is some audio. Now, I grant you, it's not the clearest of audio, but I do have the text of what she said, and I'll share that with you. So this is a Chinese woman who, according here to the Daily Wire, courtesy of them, she suffered under the brutal communist Chinese regime of Mao Zedong. She vehemently denounced Loudoun County School Board in Virginia for its championing of critical race theory. We talked about that just the other day. And you're going to hear what she has to say, and then because it's not exactly as clear as we might like, I'll go ahead and repeat it based upon the text of what she said. So here she is. She's an elderly woman. She's from China. She lived through the nightmare of what the communists did to her country and to her people, and here's what she had to say.
I've been very alarmed about what's going on in our school. You are now training our children to be social justice warriors and to loathe our country and our history. Growing up in Mao's China, all this seemed very familiar. The communist regime used the same critical theory to divide people. The only difference is they use class instead of race. During the Cultural Revolution, I witnessed students and teachers again turn against each other. We changed school names to be politically correct. We were taught to denounce our heritage. The Red Guards destroy anything that is not communist. Old statues, books, and anything else. We are also encouraged to report on each other, just like the Student Equity Ambassador Program and the Bias Reporting System. This is indeed the American version of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. The critical race theory has its roots in cultural Marxism. It should have no place in our schools.
Amen, sister. Amen. There's nothing more that I can say than amen. So let me read to you again, in case any part of that wasn't as clear.
This is frightening. That this is someone that lived through this, saw the before, mm-hmm. and is comparing that to mm-hmm. what's happening in the United States.
You're absolutely right.
Listen up, people. This is important.
Don't say you weren't warned. That's for sure. That's a good point, Cyrus. I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you. So here is from the text of what she said. She said, "I've been very alarmed by what's going on in our schools. You are now training our children to be social justice warriors and to loathe our country and our history. Growing up in Mao's China, all of this seems very familiar. The communist regime used the same critical theory to divide people. The only pause here for a second. Do you think that it's been pretty effective in recent years to divide the American people? I think so. Do you think that we are united as a people? I don't think so. I think the essence of America right now is division and people being at each other's throats. And a kingdom divided cannot stand, as the old saying goes." She says, "I witnessed students," this is during the Cultural Revolution, "I witnessed students and teachers turn against each other. We changed school names to be politically correct. We were taught to denounce our heritage. The Red Guards destroyed anything that is not communist, old statues, books, and anything else. Sound familiar? The Disrupt Texts movement, which is an appendage of this greater malignancy that's moving forward in our school systems, you know, to, you know, they'll say, well, we're not about banning books. We don't want to ban books. We're not like the Nazis who are burning books, but it has that same effect by seeking to, in essence, deplatform people like Mark Twain and other members of the American literary canon over the years, whose writings are deemed offensive or triggering, or for some other reason they don't like them. This is only part of that Disrupt Texts movement, but it is aligned with some of these other movements. Critical race theory would be part of this. And this lady, coming from communist China, where it was done to the tune of 60 million people who were murdered as a result of this ideology, she knows what she's talking about. And I've never met her. I don't have to meet her to know that if she lived through that and she sees the same pattern, she's got a really good point. Like Cyrus said. Continuing, she says, once again, we were taught to denounce our heritage. The Red Guards destroyed anything that is not communist, old statues, books, and anything else. She pointed out that in China during the Cultural Revolution, students were also encouraged to report on each other. She said, quote, we were also encouraged to report on each other, just like the Student Equity Ambassador Program and the bias reporting system. And she's referring to some of these policies that either are being implemented in school districts or are being contemplated for implementation. In other words, a network of snitches, a network of spies, a network of people who are going to keep tabs on their neighbor and rat them out if they see something that doesn't go along with the prevailing norms. She says, this is indeed the American version of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. The critical race theory has its roots in cultural Marxism. It should have no place in our schools. And she's right. Some other details here in this article. Let's see. Referring to an article in The Guardian, it pointed out that Mao's Cultural Revolution, which began in May of 1966, involved a cultural revolution that crippled the economy, ruined millions of lives, and thrust China into 10 years of turmoil, bloodshed, hunger, and stagnation. Chinese students sprung into action, setting up the Red Guard divisions in classrooms and campuses across the country. By August of 1966, so-called Red August, the mayhem was in full swing as Mao's allies urged Red Guards to destroy the Four Olds. These are four old concepts. So the Four Olds, they are old ideas, old customs, old habits, and old culture. Schools and universities were closed, and churches, shrines, libraries, shops, and private homes ransacked or destroyed as the assault on quote-unquote feudal traditions began. Feudal, F-E-U-D-A-L. Historians believe somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million people initially lost their lives. Many more were lost as a result of the forced abortions that were part and parcel of the Cultural Revolution, the one-child policy that stemmed from that. So when we talk about tens of millions, 60 million, maybe more, that includes all of those people who were wiped out in the womb as a result of this Cultural Revolution and an enforced measure to kill anyone or anything that got in the way of this agenda. Mao had published a letter indicting some Communist Party leaders on May the 16th, 1966. On May 25th, philosophy professor Ni Wanzi put up a propaganda sheet denouncing the university president and other administration figures, which triggered a chain reaction. As research attorney James David Banker noted, he said, that chain reaction was accelerated by working groups of ideologues sent to administer schools. Under their tenure, schools became centers of activism rather than of learning. Sound familiar? Students were encouraged to create big character posters exposing their own teachers, officials, and even their parents. So, I mean, this is within living memory. I was just a kid when this was going on, but I mean, we've lived through this and we're living through this nightmare again, but this time it's here in the United States. And as we talked about on the program just the other day, I was sharing with you the critical race theory critique that was offered by, I believe his first name is Mark Ruffo, if I'm not mistaken. I have it posted here on my Twitter feed. You can take a look at it there. But that's his premise. That's the point that he's making. And that is that critical race theory, along with some of these other issues that we're discussing here, that these are all predicated upon. And they're really just sort of warmed over, refashioned Marxism. That's what it is. It's Marxism. And the document itself, which published by Imprimis, which is from Hillsdale College, just to refresh your memory, it's called Critical Race Theory, What It Is and How to Fight It by Christopher Rufo. And it's very helpful. We don't have to go back through all of that, but it's there, and I encourage you to read it. And what you can see, like what this lady's saying, history is repeating itself. And you know the old saying, you know, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And that's a history I don't ever want to go through, and I don't want you to have to go through it either. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Janie in Lafayette, Indiana. Good morning, Janie.
Good morning. I've got a question. When my husband and I were in our 40s, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease and put on medication. And we decided to, or he decided to have a vasectomy. Well, I went to confession, and the priest listened to my confession, and he said, well, unless your husband reverses it, you're going to both go to hell, and he wouldn't absolve me of that sin. Well, we're in our 70s now, and my husband has recently started listening to Revelant Radio, and he wanted me to ask you this question. You know, what is your opinion about that?
All right. Well, the church says that, number one, a vasectomy performed for the purpose of contraception is a serious sin. So it is a grave sin. That's true. But the church doesn't require that it be reversed in order to be forgiven for that sin. So that's I think, the missing piece of the puzzle here is that the priest... I don't know what's going on in the background there, so I'll just bring your volume down, Janie. A priest in that situation would normally say, yes, you're right to confess this. This is a serious sin, and you shouldn't have done it. But the church doesn't require, as I said, the reversal of this in order to receive forgiveness. But the priest typically would encourage the man to have a reversal if it's possible. Now, sometimes financially, sometimes for health reasons, sometimes because... you know, a reversal procedure is not available where this person lives. I mean, there may be extenuating circumstances where it's not feasible or even possible for that to happen. But that's typically what a priest would do, would be to encourage him to do that. But strictly speaking, no, it would not be accurate to say that if your husband came to confession, confessed this sin, but yet didn't reverse it for whatever reason, that he would go to hell. No, that would not be the case.
All right, I appreciate that, but it's good. He loves listening to Relevant Radio, and it's brought him back into full communion with the church. So
that makes me so happy.
We love what you do.
Thank you, Janie. Well, my best wishes to you and your husband, and I'm sorry to hear that this has been troubling him, but you know, there's still time for him to, maybe if he hasn't been to confession since that time, I don't know, but this is something that he can bring back to confession if he feels as though... I mean, obviously, if he didn't receive absolution, he should go back to confession if he hasn't already done so. But I hope this gives you some comfort. God loves you and wants you to be happy. The church loves you and wants you to be happy. And rather than create barriers to that, the church wants to open doors and make it easier. Thankfully, we live in a time now where the state of the art of medicine is such that a vasectomy reversal is readily available. It costs a lot of money, but it is available. So my thinking is that for men... for whom this is possible, that they really should have a reversal. Now, in the case of a man who's now elderly and the possibility of having children seems to be pretty minor, I don't know that that would be necessary in that case, but I think it's to be strongly encouraged, if at all possible. Thank you, Janie. I appreciate the call. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Jim in Chicago. Hi, Jim.
Oh, Patrick?
Yeah, welcome.
Oh, good morning. How are you? You know, Marx is a little strong for me. I'm an old Democrat from Chicago in my 70s. I've been voting Democrat all my life. Mm-hmm. I don't consider our party to be Marxist.
I wasn't saying that your party is Marxist. No, I was saying that critical race theory is a form of, it's used, let me put it this way, Jim. Marxism is a tool, it's a political tool, an ideology, a worldview that categorizes people into the haves and the have-nots. So you've got the elites and the bourgeoisie, who would be the middle class, who have, and then you've got the proletariat who doesn't have. So the entire philosophical system is predicated upon class warfare, and it's intended to mobilize the proletariat to take up arms if necessary, but to really do anything necessary to pull down these wealthy people and the bourgeoisie and the middle class and redistribute all that money that really belongs to everybody in their view. So the Marxist theory as a political theory has that as its, you might say that that's what it's predicated upon, this class warfare. What the critical race theory experts have done is they have taken the same construct, but instead of using financially those with money and those without money, what they've done is they've reduced them now to skin colors. So the white people are, in essence, the elites and bourgeoisie of Marxist theory, and black people and other people of color are the proletariat. But they're using the same tool, and they're using it in the same way to try to tear things down. And none of that has anything to do per se, with the Democratic Party, although I dare say there are plenty of Democrats who adhere to this view. But it's not an indictment of the Democratic Party as such. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but Pat, you're talking about a certain century. Marx was in what, the 19th century, early part of the 19th century? This is America, the 21st century. To use those terms is divisive. Because, well, I mean, that's how the Spanish Civil War started. They started, we had 100 fathers. It started with communism, socialism, imperialism, anarchism, monarchy.
Yeah, Jim, being divisive is not always a bad thing. Jesus himself said that.
Yeah.
Said so.
Anyway,
I'm sorry, what was that, Jim? Oh, we lost Jim. Okay, well, being divisive, I don't know if Jim hung up or what, but being divisive is not always a bad thing. So if Jim had stayed on the line with me, I would have asked him and said, what's so bad about being divisive? If you're dividing yourself away from something that's bad, isn't that a good thing? I mean, if you are rejecting something that is in itself and has been proven to be, as communism, Marxism has over and over and over and over again been proven to be, harmful and destructive, and it brings misery wherever it pops up, yeah, I want to be divisive. Yeah, I want to divide myself away from that. Why wouldn't you want to do that? So I'm afraid that argument's a no-go. 888-914-9149. I'm happy to take on all comers. If you want to be one of those, just give me a call. 888-914-9149. We're going to go right back to the phones right after this, so please stay right there. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
This is interesting. What is this?
This is Jack White.
I like it.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's got some energy. Okay, we've got some audio from a teacher. She's a whistleblower. Her name is Dana Stangle-Plow, and she's speaking out about problems that are going on at the Dwight Englewood School. It's a school in New Jersey, in Englewood, New Jersey. She's working to advance civil rights and liberties and promote a common culture based on fairness, understanding, and humanity. And she's unhappy with what's going on there, and she resigned from her position. And I think we've got some audio on that. Is that right, Cyrus?
Yeah, we have. She's explaining why she's making this decision. And I just got to think, there's a thread throughout the whole show today. I mean, talking about the critical race theory. And earlier we were talking about transgenderism and pride and
these movements that are kind of in lockstep, moving together, not with the same objectives necessarily, but heading in the same direction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'd love it if you would talk more about that. But I do have this audio ready if you
okay, great. Thank you. And who's this courtesy of? Where did we get this audio?
I actually got this off of Twitter, and it's her. She's actually speaking to a camera, and so she released this. So she's being a whistleblower.
And I believe her organization is Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism. Okay, so yeah, let's play this, and you'll hear what she says.
Today I am resigning from a job that I love. My name is Dana Stangle Plow. I became an English teacher at Dwight Englewood School 7 years ago because as a parent, I loved how the school both nurtured and challenged my own children. But over the past few years, the school has embraced an ideology that is damaging to our students' intellectual and emotional growth, an ideology that requires students to see themselves not as individuals, but as representatives of either an oppressor or oppressed group. This theoretical framework pervades every division of Dwight Englewood as the singular way of seeing the world. As a result, students now arrive in my classroom accepting ideology simply as fact. I've seen up close how this hinders their ability to read, write, and think. They've become obsessed with power hierarchies. I teach students who recoil from a poem because it was written by a man. I teach students who approach texts in search of the oppressor, who see iniquities in texts that have nothing to do with power. This ideology limits students' ability to observe and engage with the full fabric of human experience in our literature. In my professional opinion as an educator, the school is failing to encourage healthy habits of mind, essential for growth, such as intellectual curiosity, humility, honesty, reason, and the capacity to consider multiple perspectives and weigh competing ideas. In our school, the opportunity even to hear competing ideas is practically non-existent. Sadly, as a result, the school is leading many to become true believers and outspoken purveyors of a regressive and illiberal orthodoxy. Our young students have no idea that the school has placed ideological blinders on them. Of course, not all students are true believers. Many pretend to agree because of pressure to conform. I've heard from students who want to ask a question, but stop out of fear. I've heard from students who don't participate in discussions for fear of being ostracized. One student didn't want to develop her personal essay about an experience she had in another country because she was worried that it might mean she was, without even realizing it, racist. In her fear, she actually stopped herself from thinking. The very definition of self-censorship. I care deeply about our students and our school. And so over the years, I have tried to introduce positive alternative views to our community. My efforts have fallen on deaf ears. The reality is that fear and orthodoxy pervade the faculty. Last fall, administrators told us we were not allowed to question the school's ideological programming. And on at least two separate occasions, our head of school even went so far as to tell the entire faculty that he would fire all of us if he could, so that he could replace us all with people of color. This February, during a faculty meeting, teachers were segregated by skin color. White teachers were placed into a white caucus group, asked to remember that we are white and to take responsibility for our power and privilege. I reject this essentialist, racialist thinking about myself and my colleagues, and I worry for the students. Will racial segregation be forced on them next? I am fully aligned with the values in Dwight Englewood's mission statement: community, diversity, courage, and making the world a better place. As an educator, I strive to create an inclusive classroom by embracing the dignity and individuality of each and every student, regardless of their cultural or group identifiers. My humanist approach cultivates a mutual respect and empathy, curiosity, and open-mindedness. I want to empower all students with the skills and habits of mind they need to fulfill their potential as learners and human beings. Unfortunately, the school's orthodoxy undermines my humanist approach to teaching and creates deep divisions among our diverse population, destroying any chance at a true and unified learning community. Dwight Englewood used to claim that we teach students how to think, not what to think. But sadly, that is just no longer true.
Cyrus, let's get her to be our Secretary of Education, shall we? What do we need to do to make that happen?
Yeah, she's amazing.
Can you make a few calls?
She's not alone. We're seeing. I mean, we've been talking about this for weeks. These teachers are standing up and talking about whether it's a critical race theory or transgenderism. They're speaking the truth, and they're either getting fired or they have to resign because no one's listening to them.
Yeah, we need more people like her. By the way, the website where you'll find this and much more is fairforall.org, fair, F-A-I-R, fairforall.org. One part of what she was saying here I find just incredibly telling, and I know that this is true as well. She says, in my classroom, I see up close how this orthodoxy hinders students' ability to read, write, and think. Now, the orthodoxy she's referring to here, she says, students arrive in my classroom accepting this theory as fact. In other words, people born with less melanin in their skin are oppressors, and people born with more melanin in their skins are oppressed. Men are oppressors, women are oppressed, and so on. This is the dominant and divisive ideology that is guiding our adolescent students. So she says, in my classroom, I see up close how this orthodoxy hinders students' ability to read, write, and think. She says, I teach students who recoil from a poem because it's written by a man. I teach students who approach texts in search of the oppressor. I teach students who see inequities in texts that have nothing to do with power. Students have internalized these messages that this is the way we read and think about the world, and as a result, they fixate on power and group identity. This fixation has stunted their ability to observe and engage with the full fabric of human experience in our literature. And Cyrus, I'm going to take a step in this direction here and tell you, not only do I think she's right, but I think that's the desired outcome. I think that's the desired outcome on the part of the people who are perpetrating this, at least at the higher levels. Because if they're successful, and they are being successful, they're being wildly successful, then they can control these people. Think of all these millions of students who will be eventually graduating and moving into the workforce and into positions of importance in the community, including government, et cetera. If you've got these people who are so radicalized from the time that they're children, and their ability to think critically and to think carefully about ideas and weigh up different ideas and see what might be right or what might be wrong, they've just simply been imbued with this class warfare, race warfare mentality, and they no longer really are capable of thinking, then you've got them right where you want them. And if you're the demagogue, if you're the political party machinery, if you're the next guy who rises up and says, follow me, and I'll make sure all of your problems are resolved, they're going to do that, and they'll be easy to control, as we're witnessing, as some of these, Cyrus, you've seen as much as I have all these riots and things in the street. Those people are easy to control. And who wouldn't want a whole lot more of that if they could get it and use it for their political purposes, right?
That's exactly right. I could not possibly even begin to say it as well as you just did. This is so important. Thank you, Patrick, for talking about this.
Well, thanks, Cyrus. I appreciate it. It's all, I see it this way. And the more I see it, the more clearly it's coming into view. This is all about control. So the desired outcome on the part of people who are using these techniques is to indeed hinder people's ability to read, to write, to think for themselves, to be intellectually curious, to be, suspicious. Is this really true? And if they're no longer able to do that, then you can easily control them. And that is a very dangerous weapon to wield, especially if you wield that against your opponents, whoever they may be. Yeah, isn't it weird, Cyrus? The more I look at this, the clearer it becomes. I'm sure you're feeling something similar, aren't you?
What can we do? I don't know what to do. I'm feeling to understand it and know it is one thing, but what can I do?
I think, well, honestly, I think we're doing it right now. Number one, we have an opportunity to disseminate this information to help people think about this, especially parents whose children are in the clutches of some of these maniacs who are hell-bent on promoting these ideologies.
What do I do? I mean, I have to pull my kids out of school, and I have to throw every computer device in the house away. I mean, it's like the odds are so stacked against parents. What are we to do? I feel lost.
About that. No, that's a good point. So what did Jesus say? He said, if your hand or your eye or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. Better for you to go into eternal life, he says, without your hand or your eye or your foot, than to be thrown into hell with those things. And that's obviously metaphorical, but we could apply that to this. I mean, I like technology as much as anybody. I like to plop down and watch something on Amazon Prime or what have you. I like my cell phone. I like that kind of thing. But if that were the price of me not going to heaven, I'd chuck it in immediately, you know?
Yep. Oh, it's so much easier said.
I mean, you're a good dad, Cyrus, and you would run into a burning building to save your children, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I know you would. Would you take them out of school, even though that might pose a hardship to you, if that's what you had to do to save them?
I don't know. That's so hard. I don't know if I could do it because I don't have the capability to homeschool them. I don't have that. We had to do
Many
it.
Many people don't. That's
we
true.
Did it through COVID, and we were forced to homeschool.
Yeah.
And we failed. I mean, we failed miserably. It was real. I have three kids. One did a great job. The two that aren't as school motivated. This year has been a complete wash. It's been awful. It's been a terrible, terrible school year for my kids, and they're going to be behind, especially my kid that's in high school. He's going to be behind his whole high school career because of this year.
I'll bet you. Let me be a little, Mr. Sunshine here for a minute.
I need it.
A little ray of sunshine. I'll bet you that once they get back into a normalized classroom setting, that they're going to catch up much quicker than you think.
Okay.
I think they'll bounce back.
I hope so. I really do hope you're right.
Yeah. I mean, they have good parents, and I really do think that that's probably true for most people. And then here's another thing, too, and I'll leave it at this. We have plenty of calls to get to. Not every student is going to be a good student.
Right.
You know,
and that doesn't mean they're not a good person. I mean, my kids are great. They're awesome, awesome people, easy to talk to. They're fun to be around. So it's not about that. But, I mean, taking your kids out of school to keep them away from this kind of an indoctrination – all I can do is teach them at home, the truth that I see, you know.
Let me try a slightly different analogy, then we'll go to the phones.
Thanks.
What if there were a very contagious, and I'm not talking about COVID here, but let's say cholera or Ebola or, Hansen's disease, leprosy or something. Let's say that there was some real and deadly disease that was striking down lots and lots of students because they'd go to school and they'd catch it there. Would you say, well, there's nothing else I can do. I'll just let them go to school. Or would you pull them home and do what you had to do to teach them at home?
You got me, man. I'd pull them, of course, and do what I had to do. And that's where we're at, isn't it?
That's how it feels to me.
It does feel like that.
It really does.
It feels hopeless. And so we need to create some hope.
But the hope is, and I understand why many people feel that way, Cyrus, the hope is in the truth. Jesus said, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. Sometimes knowing the truth is painful, and sometimes being freed involves some pain because you have to let go of things that you otherwise wanted to do. But I see lots of room for hope and encouragement in this, as long as people are willing to stand up and, like the teacher that we just heard from, to say, I reject this nonsense. Mm-hmm. I reject it. I do not accept the premise of it, that a whole group of people are racist just because of the color of their skin. That's false. It's demonstrably false. And when somebody comes up to me spouting that nonsense, I just reject it. And I will not accept the premise of what they're saying on the face of it. And my thinking, Cyrus, here's some room for hope and encouragement. If enough people, such as our vast listening audience, who knows how many millions of people are listening to us right now, if enough of them said, I'm not going to do that either. I'm not going to take this anymore. Yeah. Where have I heard that before? Then I think we've got a fighting chance. But if people remain supine and afraid and cowed and worried that they will be deplatformed and they say nothing and they do nothing and they don't take any action, then, then we'll be steamrolled for good. But I think there's still time, honestly. And I think that's another reason to thank God for Relevant Radio's existence. We can reach people with this message.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Patrick.
No, thank you, Cyrus. These are important things. Let's go to John in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mr. Madrid. And if I may take a wild guess. Were you born in the 80s?
No, but thanks for the compliment. I was born in 1960.
He meant the 1880s.
Oh.
Well, that's why.
No, I was born in the 20th century.
That's why I guess we get along. I was born the same year. Now, would your partner be born in the 1990s?
Cyrus, that's a question for you.
Nope, you're another 20 years off on that one, too.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to find a dividing point. I always like to look at generations because this is always generational. And just like you mentioned before, history always repeats itself. And it seems like in the 60s, when I was growing up in Catholic school, it was much more conservative. But, you know, you nailed it when you said about control. Of course, it's about control. How you get control, you get control from power. And social justice is an old Marxist term from the 1930s. So when I first heard this in the churches, it really troubled me many years ago. And it has been creeping in. I mean, this has been around a long time. It just hasn't been as prevalent as it is today. Mm-hmm. And when that Democrat caller called earlier, I was born and raised Democrat, Irish Catholic family. My parents worked in factories. This is not the Democratic Party of my parents, nor is it the Democratic Party that I grew up with.
Yeah.
This is a totally different Democratic Party. I don't want to get political, but I just want to point out that they are practicing socialist, democratic, Marxist beliefs in that party today. And if you don't recognize the truth, you can't combat the truth. If you just want to keep on brushing it aside, it's never going to be corrected. But what you said is so true. We have to speak up, and we just can't do it today. It's got to be at least once or twice a week. You got to keep reminding people of the issue. Unless
we're trying,
because they don't.
We're trying.
They don't. The people on the left don't care. I mean, they're going to drum it and beat it. And now it's come to a crescendo after 30 years, and the wokies have taken over the churches and the schools. I mean, the schools have been digressing since the 1960s, and that's why I asked you when you were born, because it seems like you have a lot of knowledge, you're blessed with wisdom, and you have been nailing it all morning as far as the issue. It just seems like the younger generations, what are we going to do? Well, speak up, stand up, go to Board of Education meetings, be heard, don't be afraid, like you say, don't be afraid to be canceled. That's ridiculous. No one can cancel you. God is with you, and as long as you pray about it and you go and walk in the light of God and you try to express your feelings with love and not hate and scream and calling people names, but just love, then that's not.
Thanks, John. Thank you very much. Well said. I appreciate the vote of confidence, and glad to know you're out there listening. God bless you. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, longer. Let's do it.
I love that. Where has that been my whole radio career?
Merry Christmas and happy birthday.
I love that. Give me some Tombstone any old day.
I knew you'd like that.
All right, Lunger. Oh, that's such a great... Thank you, Cyrus. I feel like that was a gift. For what it's worth, I posted this on Twitter yesterday, a little infographic showing, I guess, like a Planet of the Apes ape. And I said, there are days when being taken over by apes no longer seems scarier than our planet's actual future. So, okay, you don't have to say anything. You don't have to say attaboy or anything like that. That's fine. If you want to be that way, Cyrus. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Julie in San Diego. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Patrick. I just had a comment for Cyrus and for other parents out there. Yeah. I have four kids. My oldest two went through public school, Catholic school, and my two boys were homeschooled. And I want everyone to know that it's not like schooling at home. We go through Seton home study. Everything is so self-explainable. Everything is progressive year to year. You build on it. And you're actually teaching things that you already know. So it's not like you're trying to take a teacher's curriculum and translate it and then give it to your child. Mm-hmm. Everything is so well explained. They give you lesson plans with what to do day to day in every subject. And
so if I can jump in, Julie, what sounds like what you're, the message you want to give people who are reluctant or concerned about it is it's not as difficult as you think it is. Is that what you're saying?
It's not. Right. It's not difficult at all. And I would really want them to not even compare schooling your child at home through someone else's curriculum to Catholic home study. It's amazing. Not only that, you develop them and and it's a constant learning all day long. You know, if you listen to relevant radio, you're like, oh, that, remember we did that. We learned that. Yeah. And you know, since I wasn't a great developed Catholic before, I have deepened my faith because they go through the Baltimore Catechism. You have to sit there with them and you learn and you reinforce. And so like with me and my husband, we're like, okay, we're trying to live that now. We're trying to get better. So it's a win-win for the parents. And
that's,
I know,
good
it's
to know.
A sacrifice for, you know, one parent staying home but I just can't say it enough. It's worth it. It's worth it for you, for the sacrifice to, you know, maybe living within your means a little bit.
Yeah.
You know,
my wife and I did that, Julie. We had to, well, I think I told the story the other day, so I won't go back through it, but we found ourselves homeschooling our kids. Well, my wife did all the hard work. She's the one that did the schooling, but we didn't set out to do that. It wasn't our plan. We just assumed they would go through the Catholic school system, but it didn't work out that way. So we changed our, we revised things and they wound up homeschooling, and that's how we did it. And I'd like to put in a vote of confidence for what you're saying as well, that some of these curricula are quite good and they're very effective at alleviating a lot of that pressure on the mom, typically who would be homeschooling, as a way to get the kids a good education. But the lesson plans, the curricula are so well done that it's easy for the students to progress without mom having to be there hands-on every time. So thank you for adding your voice to the conversation. I concur with your view, and I really do believe, as you said, it's not as hard as a lot of people think it is. And once they give it a try, if that's the direction they go in, they're happily surprised more often than not. Thank you, Julie. God bless you. Let's go now to Jim in Chicago. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Patrick. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, welcome.
Okay. Thank you. So I wanted to comment, go back to that 1619 project, and also your comments about Maoism and the parallels we see today. It's such an important subject and very different from the prior Jim that called from Chicago. But here's my point. So what I'm trying to do is put together the critique of 1619 as a true liberal who thinks about criticism as in using logic, science, history, debate to reach the truth, and compare it to the Catholic tradition, which does the same thing, going back to Aquinas and before. And when you put those together, we all are united in our criticism of this, and we need to be brave and strong and use each other's arguments. And what I mean by that, there has been absolutely no peer review. We think about in the United States, what's made us a professional, competent society? It's the concept of professional peer review. That is, the best people in the business evaluating ideas and making sure they're good before they get published and become part of our curriculum or part of our science or medicine. None of that has occurred with respect to the 1619 Project, neither on a moral component nor on an academic level. And what I mean
not everybody knows what you're referring to. So the 1619 Project, it's dating back to the day when a slave ship came to the colonies at that point and sold some slaves. I think there were 20 slaves from Africa, and they were sold to the colonists. So that's where the name gets its project. So it's the New York Times describes it as an ongoing initiative. The New York Times Magazine began in August of 2019, the 400th anniversary of the beginning of American slavery. It aims to reframe the country's history by placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center, of our national narrative. So for those who are not familiar what you mean by that, that's what it is. So please continue.
Piece of I'm sorry. It's the centerpiece of this critical race theory. And its essence is that the Constitution was created to perpetuate a slaveocracy and to perpetuate racism forever, which is absolutely false. But I, rather than getting into an argument about that, I just want to point out some of the scholars who have been deprived. Just like in communist China, the most competent people have not had a say in this. If you look at, for example, Gordon Wood, who's the preeminent Revolutionary War scholar, you look at James McPherson, who is the preeminent Civil War scholar in the United States. They have been on YouTube, and you can type their names in and you'll see it. They were never consulted. They're highly critical of it. So it's received absolutely no peer review before it came into our schools, which is unbelievable. And that's what happens in communist socialist countries.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Mm-hmm.
And then you add to that that there's been absolutely no moral peer review. And what I mean by that is the entire progression of the civil rights movement up through Martin Luther King was about judging people by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin.
Right. Right. And that's rejected by the critical race theory people now.
That's all rejected.
I want to add one thing, though, to the conversation, Jim, just by way of a clarification. The Constitution originally did have a component of slavery in it, and this is not widely known, but it's Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1, and though it does not refer to slavery, or it doesn't, I'm sorry, it doesn't say slave, it does talk about it prohibits the federal government from limiting the importation of persons, and that is obviously slavery. So there was a provision in the Constitution originally that was there to accommodate slavery. So that's real. It's not, you know, people aren't making that up. And that is part of the history. We have to deal with that. But anyway, I've got to press on, Jim. Thank you for adding your well-spoken comments to the conversation. I do appreciate it. Let's go now to Juan listening in Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Juan. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. My question for you was, what would you say to people that say that the U.S. should copy the democratic socialism of the Nordic countries?
Well, I mean, I've looked into this. There's a very good book on socialism by Dinesh D'Souza that I think you would find interesting because he gets into that issue as well. And to what extent are those so-called democratic socialist countries really socialist? I mean, unlike, say, a hardcore socialist country like Cuba or Venezuela, for example, and socialism in that form always fails. And some people say, yeah, well, what about Denmark? What about Sweden? And what about those democratic socialist parties? So I would tend to favor what Dinesh D'Souza says on this, and that is that that's not actual socialism. It's like socialism light, or maybe it's a democratic form of government that involves capitalism, and it's got a few socialist things sprinkled on top of it, but it's not real socialism as such, the way you would find it in Cuba or Venezuela or other countries like that. So I'm in favor of it this way, Juan. I would say if there's a society that operates on the basis of a kind of benign and moral form of capitalism that seeks after the welfare of all people, including the poor, people who are disadvantaged, people who really need extra help, I'm all in favor of doing that. I'm not at all opposed to the state giving these ways of helping people to people who really need it. I'm in favor of that. And I think we should do more of that. But at the same time, I definitely champion the rights of private property. I think it's immoral and wrong for people to have their earning power curtailed by the state, or to have the prices that they can buy and sell goods for driven by the state. The ways in which socialism has failed over and over again, wherever it's really tried, I don't want to see those things, but I think I would have a fine time in Denmark or a fine time in Sweden, and I don't think I would be bothered by that version of what they call socialism. Does that answer your question?
I think so. What's the name of the Dinesh D'Souza book?
Socialism. If you look it up, you'll find it. It's a New York Times bestseller. He came out with this in the last year or so. And I don't have my copy in front of me to refer to, but it's got socialism in the title. So check it out. I think you'll find it instructive and illuminating. Thank you. Let's go now to Mike in Denver. Good morning, Mike.
Well, good morning, Patrick. How's it going?
It's going well, thank you. It's almost over. Oh, Patrick, we've got about 90 seconds Patrick. Left.
Okay, my question is, I'm talking to some Protestants lately, and they talk about angels mating with humans, and they made giants, and to me, it just doesn't make any sense. But I do have a good song for it. It's called School Days by Stanley Clark, so if you guys could check it out.
Oh, it's a great bassist. So. I like Stanley Clark. Yeah, he's a good bassist. Okay, well, so they're referring to Genesis chapter 6, where it talks about how the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them, these were the mighty men that were of old, the men of renown. So it was believed from antiquity and well into the present era that this was some kind of a carnal union between fallen angels and women, and that somehow they produced these giants. Now, we're out of time. So I'll just tell you this much. That's not what happened. This is referring to the good people, you might say, descendants of Adam and Eve, who seem to have been intermarrying and intermingling with the descendants of Cain. Now, there's much more to it, but I can tell you St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine reject the earlier theory. That's all I got for now. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless
you. Thank you, Cyrus. You're a genius.